Welcome to Water for Fighting. We discuss the past, present, and future of water in Florida with the people who make it happen. I'm your host, Brett Cyphers. This episode's discussion is brought to you by Sea and Shoreline and Resource Environmental Solutions. Sea and Shoreline is the Southeast's leading innovator, protecting coastal communities from devastating storms and restoring ecosystems that once faced ecological collapse. Visit their website at seaandshoreline.com. And of course, Res. Res is the nation's leader in ecological restoration, helping to restore Florida's natural resources with water quality and stormwater solutions that offer communities guaranteed performance and outcomes. Check them out at res.us. If you enjoy the discussions here on Water for Fighting, I think you'll also want to check out the Florida Specifier and the Florida Specifier podcast. Specifier has become Florida's environmental news source of record, and the podcast is your go-to place for staying up to speed on environmental news and newsmakers here in the Sunshine State. You can join the discussion as we explore the latest environmental news and developments that matter to you. Go to www.floridaspecifier.com to check it out. All right, this is it. The final episode of season 4. I know the season has been spotty in terms of episode frequency, so I'm grateful that so many of you stuck with me this entire time and are still listening. We have some really cool things in the works for season 5, and I'm working really hard at getting those conversations recorded and out to you at a quicker pace this time. Let's get to our guest of honor for the last episode, and that's Lisa Moore. Lisa is a fairly new friend of mine, but she's more of a friend to Florida's water resources for many, many years. She's a fourth generation Floridian and has been a resident of Crystal River for over 50 years. She holds 2 degrees from the University of Florida, 1 in zoology, and a graduate degree in education. She's a founding member and president of Save Crystal River, whose mission is to restore Kings Bay and the entire Crystal River ecosystem and create a statewide model for ecosystem restoration and protection that's been rooted in hard work, community partnerships, and most importantly, tangible results. And we were just talking about that before we started recording, Lisa. And thank you so much for joining me today. That's awesome.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
So before we jump to the part where we get to the results, let's start at the beginning, as we do with all of my guests. Where were you born and where were your parents from?
Well, I was born in Sanford, Florida. I'm a native Floridian. I was born right there in the old Sanford Hospital down by Lake Monroe. My dad is from Jacksonville, Florida, was from Jacksonville, Florida. He was multi-generational side of the family in Florida, mostly in Williston and Jacksonville and Osteen. He worked for Florida Power right after high school until he was drafted into the Army during Korea. And when he came back, he went right back to work for Florida Power and stayed there, taking every class he could, till he became the position of nuclear operator at the Crystal River Nuclear Plant. My mom was born in Alabama, but came here to Florida when she was 5 years old. And they were farmers and preachers and store owners, and she was one of 7 children. She actually was a vice president of Crystal River Bank. She worked there for over 30 years, and that wasn't very common for women back then. And so they were married 25 years until my dad passed away of a heart attack at the age of 46.
Wow, that's super young.
Yes, it was very young and very unexpected. So, but she was tough, and she kept on going, and I think I got a little bit of that.
Yeah, I should say so. I want to get to some of that in a bit, but how old were you when you did move to Crystal River? I know that you came here to Florida Power. It's like, but when did y'all actually come to Crystal River? It was like immediately after you were born, or?
No, I lived in St. Pete and a couple of other small towns around there. I moved here actually on my 9th birthday. I came here with my parents, you know, before that, but for the birthday party, it was at my house here in Crystal River.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So was it a tough thing in terms of transition? I mean, 9 years old, I guess, is probably not the worst age to deal with the move, but you probably established some friends in school.
I could not have asked for a better place to move to. We moved into a little neighborhood called Tropic Terrace. It was on the other end of town. Had to ride a bus to school 2 hours because there weren't that many buses. And our bus driver, John Brown, started in Ozallo on a boat, went out to the islands, picked up kids, put them on the school bus, and then drove. We drove all the way. They came, picked up Tropic Terrace kids, drove all through all kinds of neighborhoods because there just weren't that many buses. Wow. And 2 hours later, we got to school, same thing in reverse on the way home. But there were tons of kids in that neighborhood out at Tropic Terrace, and a lot of them I'm still friends with today. We've all grown up. We went to school together, went to church together, played in the river together. So yeah, it's been idyllic.
That's wonderful. That may be the first time I've ever heard of it, is someone being picked up by their bus driver in a boat to go to school. That's a wild one.
Yeah.
And I mean, was it folks on an island, or like where did those kids that had to come over, or is it just like you're on the other side of a river and it's easier?
Oh no, they lived on the islands.
Oh wow.
Yeah. And it was amazing that, you know, they had a little schoolhouse out there till a storm got it. And then when that was gone, then they would have to go out and gather them up in boats, and he did, and then bring them back, put them on the bus, and take them to school, just like the rest of us. It didn't think twice about it. We just did it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, like, what, you know, some of your early life memories, but it seems like, let's, you know, continue that thread down a little farther and tell me what that life was like. You said you had a bunch of kids in your own neighborhood and, you know, kids on islands and on boats. And so I know that water obviously here is super prominent, super, you know, big part of, you know, folks' lives. Tell me about what it was like, you know, being a kid in that environment.
Well, out in Tropic Terrace, you were just turned loose. I mean, that was back when parents could do that. And kids were climbing trees and chasing each other on bicycles, having Sandspur wars. We were kind of wild. And then when you came to town, though, parents bring a group of kids to town, and we would go to the river, Hunter Springs. And Hunter Springs had the little beach there. Wasn't much there, but they had a concrete pier that went out, and it had a diving board. It had a high dive and a low dive. If you climbed up that high dive and walked out to the end, you could jump off and land right in the middle of the second magnitude spring, Hunter Wow. Springs. And it was freezing cold. There, people would throw stuff in there and see if they could get to the bottom before it got like a quarter or something. And kids just had a ball. I mean, it was, they just turned you loose. I mean, everybody had a fishing pole and a boat. And we didn't have a car, but we could get around like that. So, and you didn't have to worry about your kids back then. You just,
yeah.
They all got together.
Sounds really cool. It reminds me of like one of my childhood fantasies, which was to be like those two kids on a flipper who seemed to traveled by boat with a dolphin everywhere they went. Is that kind of like how it was?
Oh my gosh. That's funny you mentioned flipper, because my dad was an outdoorsman and he wanted his two girls to be outdoors girls, I guess. So we went camping and fishing everywhere, and he took us to the Keys one year. I actually got to swim with Flipper, the real Flipper. I was, wow. And that was back in the day when they were still doing the movie show, the TV show. And so it was a big deal. Wow. And that's what kids did. You threw them into nature. And I think that's how we got the appreciation for nature, is that we saw it in real life. It became a part of us.
Were you driving a boat before you drove a car? Was that how it worked? Yeah.
Yeah. My dad bought a little used boat and fiberglassed it in the front yard. And we had a little 9.5 horse kicker on it. My sister and I, and we could go if we could start it. And I wasn't very good at starting it. My sister was a lot better at it. She was 2 years younger, but she was stronger. And she would get that thing going. And we would just take off, be gone all day. Our parents were at work. And you didn't have to worry because the other kids were out running around out there. And all the people along the river knew your parents anyway, so you better not mess up because your parents would know it before they got home. But we would just go to all the springs. We would go swimming and diving. You could jump right into, they called it Divers Springs at the time. Now it's called King Spring. Jump right in. That's a first magnitude spring. And there would be, you'd just be surrounded by schools of fish, you know, mullet and tarpon and just any kind of fish you could think of. And they were just all around you, and you'd swim down in the springs and you could see them. Crabs everywhere. If you wanted crabs, you threw a crab trap in and you had crabs for dinner. And you wanted fish, you took your fishing pole and you caught brim, and wow. Caught brim in the backyard, you know, when we moved to the river. It was just, it's perfect childhood. I can't even imagine doing anything else.
Wonderful. And I want to come back, one, to Hunter Springs and another to King Springs, but I want to circle back for the moment And it was Joe Brown, the bus driver, boat driver?
John Brown.
John Brown. Sorry, John.
He's kind of a legend out in Ozello.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You go out there and you'll hear all kinds of stories. Great stories out there. A lot of oyster people went out there and got all the oysters. And a lot of great fishermen still are. It used to be net fishing, but, you know, mm-hmm. that got banned. But, you know, the families have been there for generations, and it's a wonderful community still.
Talk about once John Brown got you kids to school. Tell me about your schooling. Did you enjoy it? Were you a good student? You know, what kind of things did you like most about it, if you did like it?
I liked doing the best I could. I really loved school. I loved to study. I was a quick study because I just enjoyed it so much. And I liked to read. I think that helped a lot. That was instilled in me very young. And so I think reading a lot helps you be more successful in school. And I found that true when I became a teacher later down the road, that the students that could read better absorbed the information better. They didn't struggle as much. So I would tell them, I taught high school, and I would tell them, if you don't understand what you're reading in your high school biology book, go to the library and get a middle school book, or go read about a subject in mm-hmm. elementary school book. The language is easier to understand, and then you'll have a building block for what you're trying to learn now. And it actually worked.
I guess, on that note, I think at one point I heard it was probably the, you know, education commissioner or someone like that that said at this event that you learn to read until you're about 8, and then you're reading to learn. And so if you haven't accomplished that first part, it makes the second part of that more difficult. It sounds like you're confirming that.
They actually say if you learn to read in the first grade and you read to learn after that. Mm. And if you haven't learned to read by the end of the first grade, you're going to start to struggle. Hmm. So all parents out there, teach your kids to read. Teach them the alphabet. They can learn it 2 and 3 years old. And they will excel all their lives because they learn that thirst for knowledge. They learn what they like to read about. So it doesn't matter what their topic is. I don't care if you want to read the fishing magazines all day. Just keep reading. And kids that do that seem to thrive in school.
Well, let's then kind of skip ahead a little bit there and just get right, because you finish school, you go to college, and your first you're studying zoology, or no?
No, I graduated from high school, got married, thought that was a good idea. Several years later, I had 2 children, which that was one of my huge goals in life. I always wanted to be a mom, and that to me is my greatest accomplishment, is being a mom. And raising my children, still being with my children and my grandchildren. They all live here in town. So no matter what else goes on, that's my favorite thing. And when I turned 30, I decided I'm going to college. And this is always my parents' goal, for me to go to college. So I started going to night school 3 days a week and 3 nights a week. And I did that until I had finished the classes that were available here locally, and then I had to start driving to Ocala. So my son was 2, and my daughter was in elementary school, and I started taking him with me, and we would go to school. I would finish I'd pack all my classes into the morning so I could get back before she got off the bus, and I did that until I ran out of classes over at CFCC in Ocala. By then, my son was in elementary school. And I started driving to Gainesville, and I drove 3 years, including summers, and finished my bachelor's and my master's at University of Florida.
What's that drive from Crystal River?
It's an hour and a half. That's any way you go.
You tried them all.
I tried them all. Yeah,
that's a serious commute. It's like, and but I mean, you're always you seem to me it's like, and we haven't known each other all that long. But one of the things I describe you as is like a dynamo, like all gas, no brakes. Like you're determined to fix, you know, this ecosystem, and you're, you know, full bore ahead. Seems like you may have always been like that. Is that what you're, you know, referring to earlier and talking about, you know, getting some of your mom in you?
I think both my parents were that way. They were both high achievers. And I think that you just learn by example. And so I followed their lead. And it didn't matter what I was doing. If I was going fishing, I was doing it wide open. If I was doing gymnastics, self-taught, dangerous, but just never stopped to think it couldn't be done. Mm. My dad's little saying, I know it's probably other people said the same thing, can't, never could. And he would tell me that, I'd say, I can't do it. And he said, can't, never could. Yes, you can. And so you just You went with it. Okay, I guess I'm doing it.
Do you think he was? I read your bio, and so you won so many awards while you were in college. My exceedingly good student. Do you attribute some of it to starting later and like that determination, or was like, hey, you knew you were going to do fine once you got there, regardless whether you're 19 years old or 30 years old?
I looked at it like I've got one chance, and I can't drive back and forth forever. I have two children. And I need to be an example to them, and I need to help provide for them. And so I just said, there's three high schools, because I was going for high school teaching, three high schools in Citrus County. If I'm not good enough, if I don't excel, I'm not going to get hired at one of those schools, and I'm going to be driving again to another county. And so I have to be good enough to be hired at one of those high schools when I finish college. And I was fortunate enough to be hired at Crystal River High School, where I graduated from.
Talking about coming home. So why zoology, though? I mean, I know that, you know, animals and fauna are, you know, a huge part of that. And I assume that part of growing up in Crystal River is part of that. Is that the connection, or was there something else that attracted you to the subject?
Well, University of Florida had a program. They came to CFCC, and they were recruiting students to come up there to be teachers. And they said, you have three choices. I don't remember one of them now, but the other was history and the other was science. And I really wanted to do either history or science. And they asked me what my grades were. They were really good. And so they said, well, if you come to the University of Florida, because I was planning on going to USF. I thought it was an easier drive. They said, if you come up here, we will give you a full ride. But you have to get a master's degree. I could finish in 2 years if I went to Tampa, or I could go to Florida and be a Gator and take 3 years. I said, that's a no-brainer. I'm going to be a Gator. Mm. And I've never regretted that, not once, even this football season.
There's a lot of that going around. Did you always want to be a teacher? I mean, was that something you were determined that you wanted to teach high school, you know, at that point? Or was it something that, you know, that when you're choosing at the time, that's what I want to do?
Well, when I was little, I used to line up my dolls. Those were my first students. And then later on, I like the idea of teaching. I like the idea of working with people. And I thought, I don't know if I'll go into administration or where this path will lead me. Will this lead me to, I thought eventually I might become a college teacher. Thought maybe I'll get lucky and be back at University of Florida. I didn't know where it was going to lead, but I did like the idea of being in the teaching profession because I had other options. And so that's what I went for.
Talk to me a little bit about the transition. So, I mean, you came back home as a pretty obvious, you know, the reasons why. It's like, you know, I think you, like a lot of people, are just in love with this place, and it's a beautiful place, Crystal River. You come home, you're teaching. At what point are you noticing a change in the environment itself, in the river, in these springs like Hunter Springs, like King Spring?
We had a number of major changes from the time I got here. In the early 80s, I would say, we started getting an influx of hydrilla. It's an aquarium grass. It was brought in by other boats coming in, and it took over the river. I mean, there was so much hydrilla out there, you couldn't even drive your boat without having to reverse the motor and get it unwrapped off the motor. Oh. And so that was our first crisis. And then it basically filled the river. And then in 1993, we had the no-name storm. And that storm came in during the night, no warning whatsoever. People had no idea that this storm was coming. The Weather Service didn't know it was coming, and especially with the intensity that it came in. And it threw so much salt water into the community. Everybody's houses along the river were flooded. They had to pull my mother out of a window of her home because the pressure of the water inside kept the doors shut. She couldn't get out. Wow. And so that was happening all around. People were taking pontoon boats down the residential streets trying to get people out of their homes. But as worried as everybody was about the community, the damage, I don't think there was loss of life, but there were a lot of people who were devastated. Nobody paid attention to the river. Mm-hmm. Nobody knew that all that hydrilla freshwater plant had been killed by the salt water, and it all fell to the bottom and rotted. Mm-hmm. And people just, they knew there was a problem, but they didn't know how bad it was. And they didn't know that that would lead to the decomposition process that would allow the blue-green algae, Lingbia, to take over. And that's what really destroyed the waterways. It turned it into a mushy soup, ugly, slimy debris.
So a couple things there. One is, is that when it turned catastrophic, when the Lingbia showed up? And then also, for the sake of folks that are listening that don't know, talk about what Lingbia is, because it's a really interesting, gross kind of algae.
It's something I really didn't know that much about either. I knew about algae and, you know, the different types of microorganisms that lived in the river, but I didn't really understand how bad of a problem around the world that Lingbia is. And it creates this soupy, thick, gelatinous mass. It grows and blankets everything on the bottom, so the native grasses can't grow. It depletes oxygen from the water, so the crabs and the fish don't have oxygen. It's really a devastating thing that's happened, and it does happen in lakes. It happens in Australia, and it happened here to the extent that the entire river turned brown, and it was slimy. It was hanging from the boat lifts all over the seawalls, and nobody had a solution. So people were looking. I mean, even when we formed in 2012, we were saying, well, how do we get rid of this? And there was a group that was going out and raking it up. Mm-hmm. And I went out there and tried to rake it up. And I said, well, we got a 600-acre bay. I don't think this is going to work. But it was worth it. It was a try. Sure. And it brought attention to the problem. And so everybody was trying to come up with a solution. Save Crystal River went to the agencies, state agencies, mm-hmm. Swift DEP. We went to the universities, even as far north as North Carolina. And then we found Sea and Shoreline. And that was the beginning of the solution.
Let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Sea and Shoreline. Since its inception in 2014, Sea and Shoreline's unmatched experience with scientifically validated methods of aquatic restoration has proven successful across more than 150 environmental projects. The company continues to be the industry leader in rehabilitating threatened and corrupted aquatic environments with proven success in places such as Crystal River, Homosassa River, the Caloosahatchee River, and the Indian River Lagoon. I've seen firsthand how Sea and Shoreline completely reset the ecosystem in Crystal River, transforming from a mucky, algae-dominated system to one with plants that actually belong there. The water used to be full of Lingbia and hydrilla, with a thick bottom layer of muck that smelled like rotten eggs. But with Sea and Shoreline's comprehensive muck removal and planting of native eelgrasses, the system is now beautiful, crystal clear, with lush eelgrass meadows. The manatees are feasting, fish have returned, ecotourism is booming, and property values have significantly increased. Sea and Shoreline is committed to restoring and preserving Florida's communities and aquatic ecosystems because they're Floridians, and these are their communities too. To find out how you can partner with Sea and Shoreline to help your community, visit them at www.seaandshoreline.com. You'll be glad you did. All right, back to the conversation.
Talk about, before you widen to like that wider solution, talk about the maybe an attitudinal change from a local front. I mean, was it, there had to have been more than, you know, than you and a few other folks, you know, that said, gosh, we got to do something about this, and to finally act. Is like, how much effort did you put into gathering that kind of groundswell of support for that, those next actions that you were going to take from the community itself? I mean, was it your teacher? How much educating were you doing?
Well, we were learning ourselves. We didn't know what to do either, but we were searching online and looking for, I learned more about algae than I ever wanted to know. And so it was just a small group. When we started our first project in 2015, we got our first appropriation from the legislature, $1.6 million to do 2.6 acres. And when we first started that, nobody thought it was going to work, thought it was a huge waste of taxpayer money. We didn't know if it was going to work for sure, but we knew that nothing else was being done. And this, we had seen it work at Stevenson's Creek, and we said, this looks like a process that's applicable up here. And if we start small and we keep the maintenance up, then we'll see where it goes from there. And it worked the first year. Now, also the first year, we had another hurricane come. So it killed some of it, right. But the rest of it came back. and we replanted in some areas, and then it took off from there, and it became a healthy ecosystem. And the legislature and our DEP and our representatives all supported us from that moment on, and then the community started seeing it in their backyards, and they started seeing the fish come back. And we had it independently analyzed by an ecologist to say, is this working? And he said, the bass are bedding again in these restored canals. And that was our first indicator that, okay, you can see that, you can count all the little bugs you want to, the invisible stuff. But when you start seeing the bass bedding up, you know, you've got oxygen in the water again, and you're starting to restore your ecosystem. Your habitat's coming back.
Wow. Talk to me about some of those early champions of yours. Who were the first people to sponsor this thing that a lot of people said would never work?
Our very first cheerleader was Charlie Dean. He was our senator. He was from here. He was local. He used to be a school teacher here. He was the county sheriff at one time. An absolute dynamo of a man. And he said, we're going to do this. We're going to get this done the first year, and we're going to see where it goes from there. And he was right. That was his last year in office. So right behind him, we got so lucky. And Wilton Simpson came in. And he stood beside us. He came and viewed the site. And he made sure that what we were saying was accurate. And we kept showing him the data. He brought his staff down. He brought DEP down. And everybody that came here could see the life was coming back. We even had people from Rubio's office. At the time, Senator Rubio's office came here, and it was like nature was putting on a show. The day we walked out to the seawall and I was showing them the project area, there was dolphins swimming by, there were birds swimming, there was things, mullet were jumping out of the water. I'm like, okay, I haven't seen this much activity here in a while, but they picked a good day to do it.
It's like they knew.
Yeah.
So, I mean, ever since then, it's like from Sheriff Dean and now Commissioner Simpson, it seems like I don't know how much you attribute to the success that you brought to it, the persistence that you have in seeing it through each of these times. I know that, you know, Commissioner Simpson is still heavily involved and a big fan of yours. But it seems like everyone since then, where this is their district, has been on board. We're looking, now it's Representative Groh, Ralph Masula before him as a House member. I mean, everyone seems to now line up to be a part of making it successful in the long, because you still have work to do, right?
This has been one of the most unified efforts in government that I think I've ever seen. Not only the state government with, as you mentioned, Ralph Masulo, soon to be Senator Masulo, maybe, hope so. And before him, it was Jimmy T. Smith. But also, we have our local governments that are 100% on board. So we had all of our county commissioners. Tremendous amount of effort from them. When we go to Tallahassee and we start talking to people, they are supportive of us. Our local government here at the city of Crystal River, anything we need, everybody has rallied because they see what a difference it's making, and they love this place too, and they want to see it recover. And it's been amazing for tourism. We're talking billions of dollars in additional tourism as a result of having a clean river again. So we always say clean water means money, because if we can get a clean habitat, then people will want to come here. They want to build their homes here. They want to go fishing again. We've been working with CCA, and the crabs are back. If you want crab, you go out there and throw a trap out. And it's just been something people understand. And there's a lot of native Floridians. I mean, this is old Florida. It's a place where if you know what it was like, you don't want to lose it.
Right.
And if you just got here and people start showing you the pictures and they start talking about it, then they think, I want that back. I want to keep that because I want to be a part of it. And then they've been very wonderful about helping us through donations, coming to our fundraisers, going to our website and donating on the website. But everybody knows we have to save these Florida treasures because, they'll be gone otherwise.
Yeah. And I think, there's something certainly to be said for, and that's some pretty strong anecdotal evidence, dolphins and crab and bass and all of it. Talk a little bit more about, I mean, you mentioned it, but I want you to kind of give an idea of what maybe the ecologists, I think you said you had an independent ecologist come out and look at it. What did they actually say about how it was doing? It's like keep doing this, or in these spots this is good, or I mean, how did they approach, you know, measuring that success?
He would take collections off of different locations, mm-hmm. and he would measure the grass growth there. He would measure the different kinds of microorganisms, not just the number, but the species, looking at the macro organisms, the fish, and all these indicators put together would tell him if this was working and if this is something we could continue. He didn't tell us to do anything different because every time he's been out, it's always been working. Mm-hmm. Of course, the hurricanes, 4 hurricanes in a year and a half, was quite a punch mm-hmm. in the mouth. You know, it really was hard. But the county gave us funding to replant. The TDC gave us money to clean out the springs. Everybody donated. So everybody has helped in one way or another. And it's one of those things that if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Right.
Yeah. So this is working.
You talked recently with some folks at the local government level. And I think your approach and the community's approach has been all the things at once. And it seems like you've also done, the communities have done septic tank replacements, central sewer. I know that's a big part of the input. In your mind, is like that. Is that just an indication that it seems like maybe all of Citrus County is behind this? Like, we want to see this happen, and whether you've been here for 5 decades or you've been here for 5 minutes, everyone seems to be pulling in the same direction. Is that a fair description?
I don't think there's any question that Citrus County is a ecological county. We are. In every way we can, whether it's the septic to sewer systems, if it's the fertilizer ordinance, if it's the ability for people to go out there and help clean up or help plant, we've got the schools involved. Everybody in this county has done what they can. Some people can do more than others, but in one way or another, they support the project because they know how important the ecosystem is. We're the manatee capital of Florida. There's 1,000 manatees every winter that come here.
Wow.
It's warm water refuge, huge amount of warm water refuge. And before the hurricanes, there was so much grass, we were having to rake it off the top of the water because it was shading the grass below. There was just a tremendous amount of grass, but the manatees had plenty to eat. They were having their babies here. They're still coming here. They're still finding things to eat. But next year, barring any further hurricanes, that grass is really going to be coming back. We found there's a saying that Jim Anderson, one of the founders of Sea and Shoreline, has always said, and it's carried me through the project in the scariest of times. And he said, the first year, talking about the planting of the grass, the first year it sleeps. The second year it creeps. That third year, it leaps.
Oh.
And it is so true. That third year, you could just see it take off. From a single plant, the grass grows 7.5 feet in every direction. So you start one, and it grows. And before the storms, we had grass growing all the way across Kings Bay, mm-hmm. 600 acres. It was growing in places we didn't plant. But if there's lingbia and detrital material underneath, then the storms can pull it out. So we're having to do some recovery there where it did grow on top of lingbia. It pulled it out or destroyed it because the salt got to the roots. When it's in solid substrate in sand, then it has a chance to recover and the roots seem to survive the storm.
Yeah, that seems to be the real magic there, is like making sure that you're planting things in a way that where they're best suited to survive. And it seems like, is that what you're saying in the end, is that even when you have storms, if it's set up the right way, you don't have the lingbia, you don't have these other things that are choking the oxygen out of the water, it's like that it finds a way to come back.
This is a healthy ecosystem.
Yeah.
You know, 70 springs that are named, not to mention we've opened up over 800 bubbler spring vents. So the ecosystem underneath the karst system, it's like Swiss cheese, and there's water that's coming up, fresh water, spring water. And so it is a healthy ecosystem. We just have to stop destroying it from the top down. So we've got healthy animals now, and we've got healthy habitat, clean water, and we're just going to keep making it better. Not only are we doing the grass planting, but we're doing the springs restoration, and we're also doing the island and resiliency restoration.
Yeah, and I want to get to both those in a minute, Psych, but before we leave the ongoing recovery of the ecosystem from that standpoint of the muck and, and the lingbia, can you address, what that means? When somebody says, I can see a dolphin swimmer, I can see a crab, those are very obvious. Economically speaking, has it impacted, most people just point to property values, right? It's like, is it a place that people want to come live, or was it before, maybe it's the comparing and contrasting, were people giving up on this place before it began its recovery? And what has been that? I mean, I know you're not a realtor, but I'm just curious, if it's made that kind of recovery as well.
Well, there's no doubt that clean water brings people to the shoreline. If you have a clean beach, if you've got a clean lake, if you've got a clean river, people want to be there. It feels healthy. It is healthy. And the things that live in the water are healthy. You've got turtles and birds and so many things that depend on that waterway. But in terms of commerce, yes, the Helms building here, it's like everybody's discovering us. We tried to hide. It didn't work. They're here. But there's so many people that have moved here and building larger homes, and it's helping the real estate. Of course, waterfront in Florida has gone crazy. So this is just, there's so many canal systems and so many rivers. There's seven rivers in Citrus County. So there's so much for people to enjoy here that I think it has brought a lot of people into Crystal River. And it's helping the economy, but we want people to be responsible. We want them to be responsible boaters, use power poles on your boats so you don't tear out the grass. We need to educate the new people that don't know. They don't know the damage they're doing when they throw an anchor out into a pile of grass, and then they pull it up and all they're doing is throwing out the grass instead of saying, if you get a power pole or a different kind of anchor, so it's not one of those Danforth anchors, it just drags it up.
Right.
So we try to do an education through our website, through the community. We go to women's clubs meetings, library meetings, different types of ways that we can communicate with the community. We've got a tremendous school project with the elementary school. That's kind of where it started. The first year getting our first funding, we took boxes to each of the elementary and high schools, every school in the county. And the kids all decorated the boxes and then wrote letters. And we took over 6,000 letters from students, teachers, and parents to Tallahassee and say, this community is worth saving. And they believed us. They agreed to us. And it was great. Even kindergartners were drawing pictures of manatees and say, save the manatees.
Talk to me about, you mentioned Hunter Springs, you mentioned King Spring. Let's get into that, because that's something, there's two other things that I want us to touch on. And one is the latest, but you're looking at the vents themselves, because you've had storm impacts and other impacts over just, over time that have plugged essentially these second, for sometimes first magnitude springs.
Yes.
Tell me about, because you've done some of it recently. It's like, tell me about Hunter Springs before and tell me what it looks like now, because we talked last week about this and sound like an incredible transformation.
You wouldn't believe it, and unless you knew from way back in the day how it's back to where it was. It is so clean, so crystal clear, so blue, still so cold. But when we went and looked at Hunter Springs, which is the only beach, the only area that you can come by land, if you don't have a boat, you can come by land and you could walk out into the water and swim right into a second magnitude spring. But it was so occluded. The water and the lingbia was all in it, and the hurricanes dragged a bunch of the sand off the beach and dumped it into the spring vents. And so we got money from the county. They approved the funding to suction out all that sand. And the city is building a seawall now to keep the sand from going back into the spring. So we're doing preventative actions. But when we got all the way down and got all that sand out, we're like, what is all that stuff in the bottom over the spring vents? And when they took out the pier in the 80s, apparently a lot of the concrete got left in the spring or fell into the spring. There was riprap. There was all kinds of stuff in the bottom. Mm-hmm. And we said, well, we can't stop. And so we went back to Sea and Shoreland, can you get this out of here? And they came up with a method where divers actually took these big crates to the bottom and they had a big barge with a crane on it. And they would drop it down. The divers would fill it up with rocks, big rocks, pieces of concrete, all kinds of stuff like that. And then they would lift it up. So each time that they lift it up, then they would have to take it off when it got full. They would come back and they did it for 2 or 3 weeks.
Wow.
There was that much debris in the bottom. We've actually got a contest going now to guess how much concrete came out of that spring. It made all the difference in the world. The spring is flowing so strong now, the divers said they were having trouble getting back to the bottom because the force of the water coming up spring vents is so amazing.
That's incredible.
Yes, it is. And I can't wait to see what happens when the manatees find it, because they're going to have lots of warm water refuge now.
Let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Resource Environmental Solutions. Our state presents unique challenges with its diverse ecosystems, landscapes, and the many demands on its natural resources. That's why RES uses an innovative approach and creative solutions to help municipalities, agencies, and local water resource groups navigate the ever-changing landscape of environmental regulations in Florida and throughout the country. RES actively restores habitats, hydrological regimes, and ecosystem functions across Florida, from the Panhandle to the Heartland, to the Florida Keys and everywhere in between. They focus on restoring floodplains and wetlands and improving water quality, which benefits a wide array of species that call Florida home. With an unwavering commitment to Florida's unique ecological communities, RES upholds long-term stewardship practices, guaranteeing sustainable outcomes that endure. Discover more about their work and commitment to Florida's communities and the environmental challenges they face by visiting www.res.us. All right, now back to the conversation.
Let's move to one. It's like, because we, you know, you took me on a tour last week and we looked at a couple of things. One was King Spring. Well, I mean, you could sort of see where it is, but it sounds like it's suffering from some of the similar problems that Hunter is. But more importantly, I want you to talk about the thing that you and I have talked about pretty regularly for the last couple of months now. And that is these islands in the bay that used to be bigger, more resilient in terms of, you know, their staying power. But there's been so many storm impacts of late that they're to the point of disappearing, and that could have other impacts. Talk a little bit about those spots out there and what your plan is.
Before I leave the springs, though, I wanted to mention that we have been in the process of raising funds for the rest of the springs in the river. We want to clean out King Spring. We know it's occluded. We know there's a lot of lingbia and sand in the bottom of that because the sand has been moving off of the islands and filling up into the springs. So we need to open those springs back up again. Miller Creek, Three Sisters Springs, all of these springs have too much sand and debris in them, and we need to clean those out to make the river flow again like it used to. But that goes back to the islands that you were mentioning. The four main islands, there's several smaller ones, but four main islands in the middle of Kings Bay are the storm barrier for the community, for the infrastructure, for the homes and the businesses, the roadways. So when we realized 5 years ago that we were losing, we could see the islands like, wait a minute, that pass didn't used to be there. Where did that come from? Why is the island broken in two? Why is an island that used to be, you know, a stone's throw apart, now 4 or 5 boat lengths apart? They're disappearing. Where are they going? And so we started looking into that and talking to Sea and Shoreline about it. And we've now come up with a resiliency method that we would like to do on those islands. And it's very natural. It looks like it's all engineered and everything, but it's very natural, where they will be able to replace the shoreline and then build behind it and plant plants behind it so that it naturally rebuilds that shoreline where it was. We've lost over 125 acres on those four islands, and it's accelerated in the last 10 years.
I've heard that it's not just, hey, this is a good thing for, whether it be, you know, storm wave blunting, you know, that's why, you know, a lot of these barrier islands are, you know, one of the major purposes of them is to help with that. But I also, one thing I heard in the last week or two, which I thought was interesting, was it also helps, their existence helps to regulate the salinity in the Bay versus being out in the Gulf of Mexico. Is that your understanding as well? Or
we haven't really focused on the salinity changes there. Mm-hmm. I'm not really sure if the islands are the cause of that or the buffer mm-hmm. zone for that. I mean, there is a lot of plants on that island. So if there was more salinity and the type of plants that can survive in that continue to grow, then that would be a buffer. But for us too, we look at every time an island disappears, where's that sand going?
Right.
It's going into your spring vents. It's decreasing the habitat for the manatees. It's decreasing the habitat on the surface for things like bald eagles and all kinds of animals that live on the surface of these islands. Mm. We have to watch the boating because the waves cause a problem out there. But just in the last 11 years, we've lost 3.5 acres in two of the islands, which has been about 10 feet per year, which is about 2.5 football fields.
Wow.
So that's a lot for such a small area.
Sure.
And we have to rebuild those because right now they're having inroads between the islands and they're chopping them up into smaller pieces, which will make them erode even faster. That's our protection. It's our habitat. That's one of the things we decided we're going to restore those as well. And we've come up with a great system, this resiliency system that we Sea and Shoreline has found. And they are the ones that know how to put it in. And so we're seeking the funding and the grants and the fundraising to make that a reality. And this is the first year we're hoping to do that.
Yeah, I got the opportunity. It's like kind of, behind the curtain, so to speak. I got my first opportunity to watch you do that in person. And you were with the city. And it wasn't just about you wanting to do something in terms of resiliency for those islands and help to protect them. What struck me most was the reaction on the part of city staff. I mean, these are people that have lived here a very long time. And they saw what you were doing, and it was just basically you're 100%. And I think maybe some of that speaks to this record of yours success, where it's like everyone sort of just expects whatever you do next to work. And so I thought that was really neat to witness.
I think Save Crystal River, our group, there's less than 20 of us. There's it's a really small group, but we've got so much support from the community and from Tallahassee that we're able to continue on with this mission. And we do see it as a mission. I remember as a kid, I don't know why I always think back to this, but I was really little. I was on Dunedin Beach or one of those little barrier beaches where they had all the Australian pines, and a group of us had made a sandcastle. And the way it started getting late, we're going to have to go, and the waves were coming in, and they were coming to our fort. And they said, we got to go. Well, we can't. We got to save the fort.
Right.
Yeah. So I feel like, again, I'm saving the fort.
Yeah.
I got to do something here. And I think that the community feels the same way, too. We can. It can be done. There's no such thing as it can't be done. So it's just, you just have to have the will, you have to have the support and the funding, and it can be done. We can do all of this. We can save these springs. We've already proven mm-hmm. with Hunter Springs, it can be done. Somebody just has to be willing to do it.
We're gonna get to some standard questions I ask all my guests, but before I do that, that was a great segue into if someone wishes to help, and whether that's financially, you have some pretty big donors and small donors, but I think you love them all the same. How can people help you get involved personally, get some of those educational components that you talked about earlier on your website? How do they reach the website, and how do they reach you?
www.savecrystalriver.com, and they can learn all about our work with the school system, how we have those kids come out. They plant in their classroom every year. They plant in an aquarium. Every single classroom plants grass with water from the river and the seagrass. And they do experiments, and they bring them out to Hunter Springs at the end of the year. The whole fifth grade comes out and plants out there. So they every single year that happens, two years ago, the very first class that started planting graduated from high school.
Wow.
So this is how long this has been going on. We always need volunteers for things like that. We're going to do a volunteer event in Hunter Springs Basin in the spring, where people that aren't little kids can go out there and help us plant grass. We have talks that we do at different places. Coming to a meeting, having a community event where people can learn more. We need grant writers. We have one grant writer, and we're trying to do a lot of it ourselves. The city's going to hopefully help us with a grant writer here soon. Anything that somebody has a skill knows how to do that may be related to the restoration of the river, we're more than willing to talk to them. Reaching me is just going to info@savecrystalriver.com and just send us an email and I'll get it. Just tell them you want to talk to me and I'll call you back.
Sounds great. That's a true story too. All right, here we go. Based on that, the last 45 minutes, are you optimistic about the future of Florida's environment? I'm saying specifically the one here at home. Why or why not?
Optimism is something that you have to have, but you have to have action. If you are optimistic and you have a great plan, but you never implement it, then it's not going to happen. So you have to have people that do things. They have to go out and advocate. I'm not talking about lawsuits and all that kind of stuff. I'm talking about get your hands dirty, get out there and do it. Learn about why the ecosystems are having a problem. I don't care if it's a lake. I don't care if it's your backyard. Go out there and find out what's happening and then find a solution and then make it happen. It might not happen overnight, but you have to have enough dedicated people that will go out there and do it. But you have to have a plan. And I think that's what we've always had at Save Christopher. We've had a plan. We put it into place with a lot of help from a lot of people. And if they want to, we've been to other places. We've been down to Biscayne Bay. We've been to a number of other places and talked with them over the phone of what we did, how we did it, how we can recommend it. But the biggest thing I say is you just got to start. Come up with a plan and just jump in with both feet and go for it.
So the optimism aside, what, if anything, gives you the most concern or reason for not optimism when it comes to, you know, coastal springs ecosystems in Florida?
I think those of us that have lived here, the old Florida people, have to share those memories and those the beauty of Florida, of what it was like. And I don't think a lot of people who aren't from here, and I don't mean that in a mean way.
Sure.
I just mean that they don't know. And unless we educate them, they don't know what they're losing. They don't know what they're giving up. And it's just like A Land Remembered, if you've read that book. It's my favorite book. But, you know, they're going to do a mini series on it. There's a guy out of Tampa that's going to do a TV.
Cool.
Yes, and I'm just so excited about it because I know so much of that history. And I'm not even, you know, one of the old timers. I just talked to a guy the other night at the Gainesville Rotary Club who knew all kinds of things that I didn't know about this area because he was here, he lived here. So we have to share those stories and we have to make people understand it's not here forever unless we protect it.
Yeah.
It will go away. And it would be a shame to lose so much of that fabric of Florida that made it what it was. Not just the people, because there's some amazing people here. The orange trees, they're gone. They're now housing developments. I worry about that kind of stuff, that old growth forest, the Everglades. Everglades gets a lot of publicity and everything, but inch by inch, things could disappear. We could have a catastrophic environmental event that could cause a problem. But you just can't stop. You can't give up.
And so I think you kind of like, you're kind of reaching all around it for the, you know, for pretty much our entire conversation. It's like, but let's turn it into advice, if you don't mind. What advice would you give someone, I think especially a young person, who wants to start out in that kind of, you know, advocacy, you know, group, that whole world about, you know, someone who wants to go and get involved? What do they do?
You mean somebody who has a problem and
right.
wants? Okay. If you have a problem and you want a solution, call us and we can give you the advantage of what we've done, how we did it. Go to our website. Come here, because you really cannot believe it until you see it. There's kayaks all over the place. So you can just take a kayak. You don't have to have a boat. And just take a kayak out and ride around the river. Talk to some of the people that live here. Go to a fish camp. There's people at a fish camp that will tell you what it was like and how many fish there used to be. And if there's something changing, it's probably not for the good. And if you want to get involved in something like that, learn. Go to school. Read. Read your history. And you have to understand what you're losing. And don't lose it. Just refuse. Just say, we're not losing this. We're just going to fix it. And I want to be part of that story. I want to be part of that movement. And there has to be that. teach it in schools. I heard that a lot of counties are now requiring A Land Remembered to be read in their school systems, which I think is fabulous because, like I said, you know, people aren't from here. They don't know.
Right.
Yeah. I wouldn't know anything about, you know, Oregon if I went out there.
Right.
I don't know their history. Oregon Trail, that's about it.
Right. Well, I think that's excellent advice. That's an invitation that people should take advantage of. And I think that's a good place to stop for the moment. Lisa Moore, thank you so much for your time and your energy and your willingness to talk to me for a little while.
Thank you so much for highlighting this effort at Save Crystal River and the amazing work done by Sea and Shoreline. Because without Sea and Shoreline, none of this would have happened. It honestly would not have happened. When groups like that and organizations like that, businesses like that start, they make all the difference. And we just have to be on the other end of it, you know, going out and trying to advocate for it. But they know the science behind it. That makes a difference too. You've got to get the right people behind you. People will tell you a lot of things, but ask for the results.
Yeah.
And they've got the results to prove it.
Yeah, it's certainly a team sport, this sort of thing. So, and I certainly won't argue with you about your assessment there, but that's a little biased coming from me as well. All right, that's it. Thanks for listening to Water for Fighting. If you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe on whatever platform you use, and don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review. You can follow the show on LinkedIn and Instagram at FLWaterPod. And you can reach me directly at flwaterpod@gmail.com with your comments and suggestions on how great Lisa is and how you want to know more about what she's up to, or, you know, another show that you want. Production of this podcast is by Lonely Fox Studios. Thanks to Carl Soren for making the best of what he had to work with, and David Barfield for the amazing graphics and technical assistance. A very special thank you goes out to Bo Spring from the Bo Spring Band for giving permission to use his music for this podcast. The song is called Doing Work for Free. And you should check out the band live or wherever great music is sold. Join me next season for more amazing conversations with the people who have helped shape water and environmental policy in the Sunshine State and beyond sometimes. Until then, keep your whiskey close and your water closer. Thank you.